Very briefly, Caroline, your political CV, because it's quite weighty, I've looked at it, but just tell us briefly the main highlights, can you?
Well, I was a Member of Parliament for Meriden for 22 years after working in agriculture for 15 years. Meriden, in case you don't know, is, maybe you do know, it's basically a slither of green space that keeps Birmingham and Coventry from just merging. And when I entered Parliament, I went into opposition for quite a long time, several cycles of the electoral cycle. But opposition is quite a good experience to have. I think it makes you really appreciate if your party is elected to government. It's a precious thing. You know, don't take it for granted. And then I did almost the same length of time during the time of the coalition government when I became a cabinet minister responsible for environment, and then returned to the backbenches. And I had a spell as a senior backbencher, which I also really enjoyed, because you have an opportunity to do different things as a senior backbencher. And then when I retired from politics in 2019, I didn't fully retire, because I was just sharing with Gareth that by 22 years of working as an MP, you really do understand how Whitehall works, how government works, what the challenges are of working in it. And so I volunteer my time to different causes that I care passionately about, because on the whole, outside of politics, people are not all that familiar with the workings of government, and you can really help charities and other agencies with how to achieve the outcome they want, giving them a bit of a glimpse of how it works in practice.
Okay. Now, when we were talking earlier, you talked about politics as your vocation.
Yes.
Can you unwrap that, and what did the Christian faith contribute to that idea?
So I think it quite surprises people if I say to you, maybe not this audience, but on the whole, it just seemed quite surprising to people that you might feel a sense of calling into politics. And by the way, I was very touched by your prayers. I don't think I've ever been in a place where prayers expressed, you know, concern about cynicism towards politics. But I felt we were living and working in France, so we weren't even in this country at the time. And I just felt God calling me into politics, because I was very troubled by a practice in the industry I worked for that I felt was immoral. Basically, the export of sugar onto the world market with taxpayers' subsidies, because it had the effect of crashing the price for very poor farmers around the world. And I tried within the industry to get the change, but it's very difficult to achieve that from within. So I realized I needed to become a legislator. And so that drew me into politics. Trade justice drew me into politics. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at every stage of your life, I think it's a good question to ask, what might God be calling me to do now? Because I think each chapter of our life is different, and at every stage of our life, at every chapter, we have the opportunity where God may call us to do something completely different. So I think it's right to talk about vocation.
Mm, good. Now, I've looked up your CV and career, and I noticed that you didn't get into Parliament first time.
No.
I noticed one loss, but what you implied earlier on there were more than one. Is that right?
No. Okay. So how this works in politics is, unless you're a household name, you usually have to start in the foothills by working in what is cheerfully known as a no-hope seat.
Yes.
So I was selected for a Nottinghamshire coal mining constituency just after the miners' strike. Picture the scene. But I have to say, the people of Nottinghamshire were incredibly welcoming. I mean, they probably were never going to vote for me, but I don't think I've ever drank as many cups of tea in my life. They were very hospitable. And I learned a lot going down all the coal mines. Terribly dangerous job. I learned a lot. But it also, it tests your resolve. I mean, you're not sure till you start all of that whether you're going to be any good at it, whether you're going to enjoy it, whether the party that's sponsoring you to do it is going to have the confidence in you to move on to the next stage, which is a seat that you just might win. Well, Meriden was such, but only after I've been rejected by 27 constituencies.
Oh.
And if you don't believe me, that is written up in Jeremy Paxman's book, The English, as an example of sort of latent misogyny in society. It was very difficult to be rejected over and over.
I was going to ask you, yes. I mean, did you feel a sense of rejection and humiliation?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
And how my poor husband had to sort of scrape me up after the rejection on Monday morning to sort of try all over again. And It got very, very close to the election in 1997, and there were no more seats available. And I thought, well, maybe I just got my calling wrong. Maybe I didn't hear that right. Maybe God doesn't want me to do this. And I tried to live with that for about 6 months. And then just before the election, the Meriden constituency came up, and I got a phone call from the chairman who said, we would like to invite you to interview. I ran through the house shouting at the top of my head, I've got an interview. And my husband helpfully said, yes, well, don't blow it this time. So what I'm saying is, when God calls you to something, if at first you don't succeed, you know, there is some benefit from try and try again. And I was elected on a tiny majority of 582 on an electorate of 80,000 people after two recounts, which I shall never forget.
So once you arrived at Westminster, yes. how did your Christian faith motivate what you did, your attitudes, how you coped with it all? Tell us about that.
Well, it was tough.
Yes.
I don't come from a political dynasty. Nobody in my family had any experience of being in politics. I didn't take part in a university debating society or anything like that. So it was a baptism of fire. And I really pined for my children, actually. They were quite young at the time. I found it very difficult to settle into the long hours culture. And so I made friends with people in all parties, by the way. But I made friends with a group of Christians, and we formed a little prayer group. I found it incredibly helpful. We would meet together once a week, and especially for us newbies, those who had been there for a little while, helped us understand how it all works. And they've become some of my very best friends. We're affectionately known as the G6. We had two Conservative, two Labour, one Liberal Democrat, and one now Democratic Unionist Party, but I mean to show you the spread.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people outside of politics find it difficult to understand that politicians can have friends in other parties. You really can. And I used to explain to my children, who were similarly mystified because they were helping me canvass, and you know, we were canvassing for one side, not for the other side. I said, yeah, but your friend may support Aston Villa, you support Birmingham City, you think he's crazy, but he's still your friend. So trying to help people understand that politicians of different political persuasion can actually be good friends, and actually it's one of the ways that Parliament works. Sometimes when there's a very sticky issue that no government, single government, can get through, we can think a few candidates for that, then there's cross-party alliances that help to get it over the line. And there would be candidates for that. For example, social care. That mm-hmm. needs a cross-party approach.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
That's how it works. Friends in all parties.
Were there ever any times when your party bosses said, three-line whip, you must vote this way, but you yourself in conscience really would rather vote another way? And if so, how did you cope with that?
Not often. So if it was difficult, I'd pray hard.
Yes.
Read my Bible in a section that maybe was relevant to what we were discussing. That there's a very, very precious thing in British democracy, doesn't necessarily exist in other parliamentary democracies, and that is that we have something called a free vote. So if there's a moral issue, and just think of those for a second, so the assisted suicide bill is going through Parliament, the same subject, euthanasia, came through twice whilst I was serving, capital punishment comes up occasionally. These are big moral issues. And there is no whip applied to the vote. It's entirely a matter of conscience. And that is such a precious freedom, and that is not everywhere in the world the case. So that's something to be cherished. I think there were a couple of times I can think of where I struggled a bit. Very early on in my tenure, there was a proposed change in the legislation to end single parent benefit. And I felt very strongly about that because I had a council estate of 30,000 people in my constituency, a lot of single parents. And I knew that if the benefit was removed, those mostly mums with small children were really going to struggle. And I lost sleep over it. And I was troubled by it. So my husband said, well, you're going to have to go and see the chief whip. I didn't even know where he was. I didn't know where his office was. So I eventually got there trembling, you know. I walked in to see the chief whip, and I said, look, I'm really sorry. I know I've only been here 5 minutes, but this is really troubling me, this single parent benefit cap. I can't possibly vote for this. I've got constituents who'd be called back. And he said, it's all right, Caroline. at least half of the party feel exactly the way you do, we're not going to win the vote. So you see how conscience plays out in that sort of scenario. So, you know, don't feel that, you know, it's rather nasty, isn't it? It's three-line whip. All it means is that somebody gets out with a pen and goes, 1, 2, 3 underlinings. Don't worry, there's nothing worse than that.
You've spoken of what you see as a bit of an imbalance in Westminster in terms of male and female, and I know this is an issue that you feel quite strongly about. Just tell us a bit about that and what you feel is wrong and how you can put it right.
So when I entered Parliament, only 8% of my party were female, and I was the only female parliamentarian with school-aged children. And it is not family-friendly. Even today, it is not family-friendly. And it tends to put women off applying to Parliament. So you could be sitting in here this evening thinking, well, I wonder if God is calling me into politics. But then, you, as a woman with family responsibilities, you'd have a bit of a reflex, like, how on earth would I manage that? And there have been some improvements, but it's still quite a difficult workplace. And there's been a bit of a backlash culturally, actually. I think it's coming over the Atlantic.
Against women?
Against women.
Yes.
And I think that's a real shame, because what I think women bring to... Let me illustrate for you. Women bring a different perspective, and you make a better decision around the cabinet table if you've got men and women. So if you take the issue of safety on public transport and you ask men, what's the most important thing about safety, about public transport generally, being on time, value for money, punctuality, you know, and you ask women what's the most important thing that concerns them about public transport, they will articulate security or safety on public transport. Put them both together, and you get a better decision-making process. So just as it says in the Bible, you know, that God said, you know, men and women are made in God's image, I think actually a good, well-functioning parliamentary democracy needs both.
Right. Is it true that women, and especially women of colour, are increasingly subjected to the most appalling vitriol and threats and that sort of thing?
It is. Unfortunately, I serve on some boards where, in a drive to achieve equality and diversity on boards, there's been a very proactive approach to recruiting people to serve on boards, to get that better balanced decision-making on boards. And they tell anecdotally some very worrying abuse that they are receiving, again, in a culture where I think it probably is something to do with the times we live in of greater hatred towards otherness. The church has spoken out against this, but there is considerable abuse towards people of different ethnic heritage and towards women. And I think these social media has that effect of accentuating the dislike of otherness, because the algorithms of social media drive the information towards what people find most like themselves and they like. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but I think social media is a big challenge.
And you yourselves have suffered, you said, death threats?
Yeah. Well, I thought I wouldn't get through this evening without the memory of Joe Cox.
Yeah.
Where I sat in Parliament, the plaque remembering Joe Cox, who was murdered on the way to a constituency surgery, was always there on the wall. But it really came home to me in quite a personal way during the whole Brexit saga, because it had an amazingly corrosive effect on people's interaction. It was a very emotive issue. And I started to receive credible death threats. The police told me they were. Towards me, towards my children, towards my husband. And I just, really, that's what drove me out of politics in the end. I just thought, after 22 years hard service. But the police were good enough. They always look into it. But your prayers for the safety of your parliamentarians and locally elected politicians, I think, is important. But I was vaguely reassured now that I've retired into my constituency, and I did think about that in this context. quite a few people have come up to me to say, I'm really sorry I wrote that letter. I shouldn't have done that. I didn't mean you to give up your job. And I said, well, thank you for saying that. It means a lot to me to hear that. And one of the credible threats was in an adjoining village. I won't say which one. And I did think twice, since I go to the butchers there on a regular basis, about whether I would continue. But I'm delighted to say that a normalisation has occurred. And I luckily didn't suffer in the way that Joe Cox did. Yeah. But, you know, as we know, there have been others. David Amos is another one. So your prayers for safety, much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, I think we want to commend you for sticking for 22 years. One final question.
Yes.
What advice would you give to a person, maybe somebody here, perhaps a younger person, who's thinking about going into politics, Christian, what advice would you give them?
So if God calls you into that, whatever age you're at, because, you know, people serve in local politics through their lifetime sometimes, don't ignore it, please, because it's a very important part of our responsibility, I think, as Christians, to be part of the communities that we live amongst. And I think God will keep reminding you, that was my sense, you know, it's a bit like a tap on the shoulder, you know, you think, oh, no, no, not that, and then tap, tap, tap. You know, if that's happening to you, don't ignore it. But equally, you have to go into it, I think, with your eyes open, that it is about serving other people. And as we know, you know, people come in all shapes and sizes and opinions. It's not always easy to deal with people who are very angry or exercised, but you get better at it the more you do it. But you do have the opportunity to make a difference. That is the main reason, I would say, for going into politics. So you will get the chance to make a difference. I succeeded, not single-handedly, but with others, in getting those export subsidies removed from sugar. They no longer exist now. The law has changed. And I think we do need people to come forward that want to make a difference, that are willing to take the risks that go with this. Jesus said, take up your cross, didn't he? It doesn't come without risk.
No.
But I think that it can be an amazing opportunity to serve the community that you live amongst.
Thank you.